Everyone has a story. I get them to tell it. Welcome to the Aaron Bender Podcast, conversations with media personalities about their personal and professional lives and journeys. Thank you so much for all the support. Invite you to rate, review, subscribe, share, all the stuff that you know goes along with listening to a podcast. And I invite you, head over to YouTube to the Aaron Bender Podcast channel for exclusive video content with today's guest and more. Before we get to my conversation here with LZ Granderson, a little about my story. I'm a widowed dad of two girls who just lost their mom, a grieving husband, a man in recovery trying to reconnect with the world with fresh eyes, faith, and perspective, a college journalism professor, a white guy in a world of injustice, a 20-year broadcast media veteran who had his dream job and then lost it. A year and a half ago, God gave me a gift, an opportunity to stop, step back, and breathe so I could learn about love, vulnerability, forgiveness, grace, self-care, patience, and understanding. LZ Granderson can be heard weekday afternoons 4 to 7 on ESPN LA 710, and he's the LA Times sports and culture columnist. Can also be seen on ABC News and other platforms. We talk about the guilty verdicts in the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, the differences between justice and accountability, growing up in Detroit, how he manages trauma, struggling with his racial and sexual identity, imposter syndrome, the role God has played in his life, even if LZ wasn't listening, and an unexpected deep dive into the tennis world. I started by asking him for commentary on yesterday's Chauvin verdicts, thinking he'd already been on the radio with Sedano and Cap and has had a night to sleep on it.
Well, first of all, it's great to meet you. It's great to be on. Really appreciate you reaching out. I actually didn't do the radio show yesterday. I was focusing. I also work for ABC. I'm a news contributor there. And so I spent a great deal of my time on air for ABC. And then I was writing for the LA Times. And then I did our show, the LA Times Today. And I asked for the day off from radio because a couple of reasons. First and foremost, I just wasn't in the space to like laugh and shit.
You have a lot of fun on that show.
We try.
Yeah.
We try. And I just wasn't in position to try to pretend as if life wasn't happening. Because we try to create a fantasy, you know, on the radio show where people can come and unplug and, to your point, laugh and giggle. And of course, talk about our favorite teams, but mostly just to be entertained. And I wasn't in the place to entertain people yesterday. And I didn't think that we were prepared as a show to have the kind of conversations that needed to be happening after the verdict. So it was a combination of things that I felt was best that I just focused in on the work and not try to, you know, fulfill every single obligation from jobs, if you will.
Right. Yeah. Because you have several.
I have several. But if, you know, like when, you know, the Lakers won the championship, I wasn't trying to like, you know, talk about politics from ABC, you know, I was focused in on it. So, you know, it's all about the timeliness of it all.
Right.
You know, my first thought was, we are so lucky to be here. We're so lucky because had that 17-year-old girl, or then 17, she's 18 now, not taken that video, had she not gone to that store, had she not charged up her phone to have enough power to record George Floyd being murdered, we likely would not have had a trial and certainly wouldn't have had a verdict. You have to remember, Chauvin was the first white officer in the history of Minnesota to be charged with the death of a Black civilian. So the simple fact that he was charged was already somewhat of a miracle. But we got to that miracle because of an accidental serendipitous encounter with a 17-year-old girl with enough charge in her phone to record it. So I can't talk about justice, I can't be overly celebratory because I know there's a very good chance we wouldn't even have been here. That this wasn't because the system worked, this was because the people worked. Right, so the system right. in place still needs a lot of changes. I mean, Aaron, when you read the initial statements from the Minneapolis police in regards to what happened on May 25th, 2020, it says that it appeared as if George Floyd was experiencing some sort of medical incident, having medical difficulties. The piece, the statement says nothing about Derek Chauvin's knee being on his neck for almost 10 minutes.
Right, right. And so, I hadn't seen that in, I don't know if I saw that last year, but mm-hmm. I certainly haven't seen it in a year. And yeah. after the verdict came out, there were a lot of posts on social media as a reminder, like, hey, by the way, this was what the police department initially said.
Absolutely. So do you believe that the three other officers who are all junior and compared to Mr. Chauvin, some of whom hadn't even been on, one of them wasn't even on the force for a week. Do you believe that person, those people who didn't have enough courage to tell Mr. Chauvin to stop, do you really feel like after the fact they would have said, oh yeah, by the way, he really did some things we weren't trained to do? Do you really think they would have said that? Since they didn't rise up to stop the killing, are they gonna rise up to point a finger at who murdered him? No. So my initial thoughts and really my dominant thoughts are really, you know, grateful to God and grateful for, I believe her name is Darnella Frazier, for taking the video. Because had it not been for the video, Derek Chauvin might still be out there patrolling these streets today.
Something I also saw a lot of yesterday that I hadn't seen before, and that's not to say that it wasn't out there, I just hadn't seen it, was the idea that this is not so much justice as it is accountability.
Right.
When did that start? The idea of, hey, this isn't necessarily justice, this is accountability. Has it been out there prior to yesterday, or was yesterday its coming out party, if you will?
I think yesterday people noticed it more. You know, activists that I've spoken to over the years, and I'm talking years and years and years, have been speaking in those terms for some time. Yes, activists, organizers, even some local politicians had been using that language. But you're right, it certainly has risen, you know, during the George Floyd, since his death, certainly was talked about a lot in the Chauvin trial. But it really is a brilliant way of reframing the entire conversation, if you will. You know, because to say justice is to infer an injustice has been done, which, you know, just on his head, has the potential to offend those you're talking about, right? Because they're automatically being accused of being unjust. But accountability isn't splitting hairs, it's refining the issue. It's saying this isn't about the profession not being noble. No, it's about holding the people who are in this profession accountable to the ideas and the principles and the policies and the training of this noble profession, holding them accountable to what they promised, which is to serve and protect. Now that's a reshaping. And I hope that it isn't just simply moving chairs on a sinking ship. My hope is that it really does symbolize some sort of paradigm shift, because we already know that there've been tens of killings of this nature since the trial began.
Right. And the idea that I think yesterday during the verdict, there was another
16-year-old girl. Absolutely. You know, we're still waiting to hear details on that, though we do know that reportedly she was under attack. She was the one that called the police, and she's the one that ended up dead. 4 bullets to the chest. Within, I believe the reports are within 10 to 15 seconds of the police arriving. So certainly not enough time to de-escalate, certainly not enough time to ask questions to see what was going on, all based upon the assumptions of what they were witnessing. And you have to ask yourself, okay, what was informing those assumptions?
Right.
How much of that was police training? How much of that was personal bias?
It's been nearly a year for the Derek Chauvin trial to actually happen, and then 3 weeks of trial. Take me through your mindset, your emotions, all the different things that went into the few hours between, hey, we've got a verdict, and the actual reading of the verdict.
Well, I would start in reverse. Emotions, I was at most relieved, but probably mostly unemotional.
Why is that?
Because there's a video of a man being murdered that takes place over 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Like, it's literally, it's like the bare minimum required for, as a human being, to watch this video and then walk away thinking, yeah, that guy killed that guy. I know we had a trial full of science and it was really important that we scientifically explain what happened to him, but we also instinctively knew what happened. We saw it with our own eyes. And so to feel a certain amount of elation because these jurors use their common sense, and sort of like, that just tells you just how bad our criminal justice system has been for people of color, where we need to be happy that a video documenting a death, a murder, was honored and recognized for its integrity. So I was somewhat disconnected, relief at most, but probably overwhelmingly just not emotional at all. But during the course of the day, once I got the bulletin that, you know, the verdict was going to be announced within 90 minutes, we're in the middle of a remodel. So I was in Home Depot, and I had been putting off looking for countertops, you know, because it's just like, that's not fun. That's not sexy, right? But it's at the point now where I really have no choice. Otherwise, I'm not going to have a countertop, right? So I'm going through, I'm looking, I'm trying to pick it out, and I get this bulletin, and I go, okay, I got 90 minutes, right? I know I needed to be on air. That was already decided. So that means I basically have 45 to an hour to pick this out and get back to the house, take a shower, dress, and be ready to be on air for when. And as hard as I tried to stay focused in on finding this countertop that I've been putting off, I couldn't stop the anxiety. So I just left without even doing it, because it was impossible for me to think that countertops were important in that moment. And as I was driving home, and I was listening to Otis Redding, I was listening to Sam Cooke, you know, and then I came home and I got dressed and I just sat and I just waited. And when the first guilty came in, I exhaled and then I just listened. And then I just gathered my thoughts and prepared to go on air.
Where did that anxiety go? What do you do with it? How do you handle it?
I forgot which corridor I stored that one. But I have all these emotional corridors where I compartmentalize all my trauma. So it's in there somewhere. I'm sure if I look it up, you know, in the files, I'll be able to pull it out for you. But I just kind of quickly put it away in the file along with all the other trauma that I've experienced in dealing with law enforcement. And I don't want people to think that I'm anti-law enforcement. I don't want people to think I'm anti-police. I have friends who are police officers. I have family members that are police officers. More importantly, I have a tremendous amount of respect for police officers. I have been a crimes reporter. I've been out in the streets with police officers. I've been to shootings. I've been to murders. I've been to death with police officers. I understand all that goes into it. I'm speaking specifically of both the bad acting agents, the bad officers, as well as the so-called good officers who aren't quite good enough to call out the bad ones who are not just harming civilians, but really damaging their entire industry, their entire profession.
Pardon the pun, but the idea of this black and white, like you cannot be both. You cannot be both supportive of law enforcement and call out law enforcement. You can't do or be or feel both.
One of the things our founding fathers warned us about, warned future generations about, was the pitfalls of a two-party system. And they got a lot wrong, obviously. I'm living proof. I'm not three-fifths. I'm actually completely human. But they got a lot right, which is why, you know, a lot of us today still quote them and still point to them, because a lot of the philosophies they talked about was right. And the dangers of a two-party system is that it places the electorate in a position of having to choose between, unfortunately, two extremes. Because more often than not, the truth and our sensibilities as humans lies in between those spaces. So they've always, you know, encouraged us to make sure there were multiple parties so that people weren't, you know, ghettoized in these two positions. And to answer your question, that is just another example as to why we need space for more choices so that we don't have to take harbor underneath these two extremes, because most of us are somewhere in the middle. Just as you know, there are restaurants that suck. That doesn't mean that all restaurants suck. You know, just because you know there are some awful teachers doesn't mean the profession of teaching isn't necessary or needs to be destroyed or disbanded. So the same thing applies to when it comes to law enforcement. There are wonderful officers out there who are taking less money than probably what they could earn as being public servants, who are risking their lives every single day. They put on that uniform, they put on that badge, who many of whom don't think a second thought when it comes to putting themselves in harm's way to protect people. We're not talking about those people, those women and men. We're talking about the ones who push you in front of the bus and then blame you for getting the street dirty. That's who we're talking about.
Tell me about life growing up in Detroit.
Which aspect of it? There's a lot there.
That's why I just ask it the way I ask it, so that you can take it where you want to take it.
And I was a kid, and certainly hindsight, I'm able to see the world in general, but growing up in Detroit specifically, very differently. But as a kid, you know, I didn't know we were poor. You know, I didn't know that our neighborhoods were, you know, redlined and our schools weren't up to snuff. Like, I didn't know any of that. So I don't really have anything to compare growing up to. But I do recall the first time I knew that police were going to be a problem in my life. I was 12 years old. My mom had sent me to the store to buy some milk. I come home with a gallon of milk, and an officer, a plainclothes officer in a unmarked car, pulls to the side of the road as I'm walking, starts asking me questions. I start moving faster because he's a stranger and I'm 12 years old and I'm always taught never talk to strangers. He starts driving faster. I run because now I'm afraid I'm being kidnapped, and I start yelling, "Help!" The car speeds and chases me. I still have no idea who this person is. I can hear the car screeching to a halt as I'm running. I can hear the gunfire, and I can hear the officer saying, "Stop or I will shoot you." I remember his knee in the back of my, I remember his knee in my back. I remember the handcuffs. And I remember him saying something about a string of burglaries in the area, and I looked like someone that they were looking for. 12-year-old kid, no facial hair, with a gallon of milk, skinny as all get out, completely traumatized. And that wasn't the moment that I realized that police were going to be a problem, though. I realized it when I got home and I told my parents what happened, and they said there was nothing that we could do. That's when I knew police were going to be a problem. Wasn't just what happened to me, but knowing that my parents couldn't do anything about it, which got me thinking, this must mean their parents couldn't do anything about it, which must mean their parents couldn't do anything about it. That's when I knew. So growing up in Detroit, a lot of positive memories, a lot of joys. Shout out to you, Detroit Women's Dance Academy. Shout out to you, Cass Tech. Shout out to you, Bates Academy. Shout out to you, Minjos. Shout out to you, Movement Festival. Shout out to you, Heart Plaza, and all the other wonderful places that helped shape me.
Is that when you first developed these emotional corridors and these file boxes?
No, it happened before that. I just didn't have a vocabulary for how I was processing it. But I grew up in a household with an abusive stepfather, so I had already figured out. Plus, there was some weird shit going on with me internally that I later realized was just me being gay, but I didn't have the vocabulary and couldn't process that either. So compartmentalizing life was something I learned to do very, very early, probably in elementary school.
If you had processed that that internal struggle, if you will, early enough, that it might have actually been worse for you, considering your stepfather was already abusive. I can't imagine a young black man growing up in Detroit with an already abusive stepfather, and, oh, by the way, I'm gay.
It was a lot. I'll admit, it was a lot. But again, it's a lot when you think about it in retrospect. As I was trying to just live from one day to the next, start on Monday, just trying to get to Tuesday. I just did the best that I could. And I realized now that best was simply not dealing with things or even processing things, but just storing things, assuming that I would get to it later. Kind of like the way we do old mail. We just collect it, assuming we're going to open it later, but we never do.
I didn't know that the pile of mail was actually on the video camera right now, but I guess it is. I guess it is.
Oh, we all have. You want some mail? I got some right here on my desk. Some of this stuff.
Oh, LZ.
I'm sure it's 2019. I'm pretty sure.
I do appreciate, by the way, the attempt at organization. Like, it's not just a pile, but it is. It's just a pile stood up on its end.
No, I'm still like everybody else. I may not be as messy, but I'm still like everyone else. That's a very organized pile of shit. So,
aren't we all? Like, really?
Absolutely. What's that tat you got there, brother? What is that? I'm a tat dude. So
I've got headphones and microphone. I got that on the air in studio as part of a charity fundraiser. And then these are my daughter's names. So here's,
I'll take your word for it because I cannot read that.
So here's Marin.
Okay, I see that.
And then if I flip it over, that's Wiley.
This one. Ah, yeah. Awesome. Very, very cool.
That one matching with my wife. She passed away in November, so I'm going to try to get some sort of something to go along with that involving her name. We'll figure that out. In the last year and a half, I feel like I've developed a decent vocabulary and a decent handle on, why I am the way I am and the trauma that I've experienced. When do you feel like you started putting pieces together, putting the puzzle together with either vocabulary or, just maybe books you've read that kind of started connecting dots?
That's a great question. I believe in terms of my racial identity, that began in high school. That's when things started to click. That's when the readings helped inform and shape what I was experiencing. That's when that vocabulary developed. But in terms of my sexual orientation and the intersectionality of my race and sexual orientation, that's an ongoing process. And the reason why is because while obviously being a person of color in America has its history and its present, the community, the Black community, still had each other. And we still accepted each other. And we knew how to find each other. And we knew how to support each other. We knew how to celebrate each other. When it comes to sexual orientation and being gay, our community, especially for me growing up, we weren't afforded those same level of acceptance in terms of creating space for ourselves, because we were always in mixed company, always in mixed company. One, because it was very difficult to really figure out who else was gay, right? Especially when you're really young,
right?
Being Black, you can kind of see like, oh, that's where the Black people are. It's really hard to go, that's where the gay people are. Mine is a drag show or something like that. And once you find the gay people, you realize the same race shit is there too. Right? So the amount of racism I experienced from the larger gay community really put me in this really weird position of trying to decide if I wanted to be gay that day or Black that day, and it was really like an ongoing sort of negotiation as I tried to navigate some of these gay corners or gay pockets, right? Because cisgendered white men were still the dominant factor in the gay community, just as it was in the larger part of American society. So while we could find commonality in terms of feeling, you know, persecuted and prosecuted for being gay, we kind of splintered off a little bit when it came to applying that to the other aspects of life. You know, yes, I'm gay, but also because I'm Black, I'm experiencing life this way. Well, the Black part separated us. Oftentimes, they weren't interested in having that conversation. And for a number of years, I would watch other gay men try to live their lives as white men because being gay and Black was too much work.
Have you ever had thoughts of, God, I wish I wasn't Black. I wish I wasn't gay.
Never I wasn't Black. Definitely I wish I wasn't gay. Never I wasn't Black. Never, 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 never. Wasn't gay? Yep. Didn't come out? Most definitely. Which is weird in a sense that since I've come out, I feel as if my voice has gained strength in terms of fighting for issues that are important to the Black community. It was as if the work I was using to hide myself from myself could now be used in more productive ways.
That's powerful. That's powerful. What went into the decision back in 2012 to come out? You were a CNN columnist, I believe.
I've been out longer than that since 2012.
Oh, okay.
I've been out my entire professional life. So I've been out since like 97, 98. You may have read the piece in the CNN or something like that, but I certainly had been out.
Okay, okay.
In my work too, many times before. I've written about being gay like back in the 90s.
Yeah, that's my bad then. I'm taking all this out so that I don't seem like an idiot.
No. It's fine. No, a lot of people have said that to me, and my only assumption can be whatever the fuck I was writing back then wasn't nearly as popular as I'm writing now.
Oh, yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of, because I've been out this entire time with men of all ages and races. Actually, that's a lie. Not all ages, because I really don't fuck with dudes in their 20s. But got enough to deal with, then also dealing with your youth too. but yeah, I've been out in public, you know, for a very long time.
What came first, the acting, the journalism, the activism? Take me through that timeline.
I was a writer first. I was a writer before I was a journalist. Started writing when I was like second, third grade, poetry, and then just slowly sort of progressed from there. It was acting writing that led me to theater, because I wrote a play, and then I won a citywide contest in Detroit for that play, and had this great playwright by the name of Ron Milner. You may not recognize his name, but he was a very influential Black playwright, particularly in the 70s. And he was in Detroit, and he came and directed my play because I had won this contest. And that's what got my wheels spinning in terms of becoming a thespian. And so when I went to high school, my school had a performing arts curriculum. So I did a performing arts curriculum, which really helped me with my speech, but also clearly helped me get comfortable being in front of camera. And then also just learning how to convey emotions that may not be intrinsically mine, but belong to this character. And I just kept working at it and getting better at it, and then started getting cast in movies and stuff like that. And then I left because the main reason why I left was because I didn't like the idea that my intelligence was discounted in the process. That it didn't matter to casting agents that, you know, I went to school or my worldview on like international politics or domestic policy. All that mattered was if that particular day they liked my smile. And, you know, more often than not, and I think every working actor can tell you that, more often than not, the answer is no, they don't like your smile, which sends you on like this terrible sort of journey in terms of trying to build your self-esteem back up as you go out to have it torn down arbitrarily by people who may or may not like the crook of your smile or the amount of teeth that's shown or the fact that you show teeth when you smile. Some casting agents prefer that you don't show teeth when you smile. Some people wow. don't shake your head like that. When, you know, you never know what that casting agent is looking for, right?
Right.
But what, you know what they're not looking for, which is you, right? They're looking for you. They're looking for something that fits an ideal for this character, but they aren't necessarily looking for you. And I had worked too hard in my life to figure out who the fuck I was to then spend the rest of my life in a profession having that ignored. So I left and I went to grad school and I went, took my writing and I became a journalist and here I am.
Where'd you go to grad school?
I went to Grand Valley State University, which I went to Western Michigan University, which is in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And Grand Valley State is about 45 to an hour north of that. So both schools were on the western side of Michigan.
Before we move on from college, I want to go back and find out how supportive was your family with your writing and how much did they nurture that? Or did you have to just kind of do that in your own bubble as well?
Most of that was done within my bubble. And that's not to, you know, as a slight on my family, but I mean, my parents both were working, pulling doubles whenever they could to make ends meet. You know, my stepfather was functionally illiterate, so he was not going to appreciate my writing anyway. And my mom did not graduate from high school. So it wasn't as if, you know, they encouraged me in the sense of going to school and prioritizing my education. But in terms of getting into the weeds of what that meant and what that looked like, they just weren't, you know, able to do that. They didn't have that bandwidth. Life decided other things for them. And they did well for themselves with the opportunities that they had. But they certainly were limited opportunities for a variety of reasons. Both of them are from the South. Both of them came up north under the Great Migration, obviously looking for, you know, better work, which tells you that the lives they came from was a life they needed to get away from. So I don't begrudge the fact that they weren't in the weeds with me trying to help navigate me in this process. They both encouraged me to go to school and get a better education. But in terms of, oh yeah, this reminds me of Richard Wright or something like that. No, that wasn't happening.
Take me after college then. Where did you go after college? And also I'm just kind of thinking about the idea that here we are, we're talking in Los Angeles. Yes. When was the first time that you left Michigan?
Left Michigan like for work?
Just in general. I mean, the idea that there are...
We left all the time.
Okay.
We left all the time because, as I mentioned before, both of my folks are from the South, so we would drive down to visit parents, grandparents, okay. all the time. And I have relatives in Chicago, so we would go drive over to see them all the time too. So I was blessed. I kind of get where you're going, and I was blessed that my worldview wasn't limited because I never left like my blocks.
That's exactly where I was going. The idea that I just talked with Alex Michelson from Fox 11, and he covers stories. He'll go to Watts, and he knows that the kids there have never been to the beach, and
right.
And the idea that the people at the beach have probably never been to Watts.
Right.
So that kind of what I was getting at with the idea that you grow up in Detroit, you have no idea really that you're poor because your existence and your life is just what it is. You know, he's going to school in Michigan. He's going to grad school in Michigan. Did he ever leave Michigan? You know.
Oh yeah. We certainly left a lot. Believe it or not, Aaron, I wasn't always doing the things I needed to do. But part of the reason why I didn't necessarily like go to like a different school in a different state or something like that, I didn't graduate from high school on time and hadn't really planned on going into college. I had no plans. You know, as I mentioned earlier, my folks knew to encourage me to get an education, but they didn't know the steps of what I needed to do in order to get accepted into like a Yale or a Harvard or anything like that. So even though I very well could have been capable of excelling in an Ivy League school or an HBCU or any other university outside of the state of Michigan or University of Michigan for that matter,
right?
I didn't know what to do. And I wasn't necessarily doing what I needed to do where I was anyway. I was selling drugs. I was, you know, skipping classes. I wasn't being a good student. I wasn't being a good kid. wasn't violent necessarily, though I did certainly fight a lot. I was, you know, fought a lot to protect myself, fought a lot to intimidate others. It's kind of like a little, you know, Lord of the Flies scenario a little bit there. But I didn't even know what it meant to be prepared to go to college. A lot of my secondary education and then post-secondary education was really just about just trying to make it from Monday to Tuesday. And then if I looked up and it was Friday, well, hallelujah, because that wasn't the plan. I was just trying to get from one day to the next. Some people have the luxury of saying, well, this is what I'm doing on Friday. I was just trying to get to the next day.
Here you are nearly 50 years old. Do you think back to those days wondering, how did I make it?
Oh, I know how I made it. It was God. I didn't have shit to do with it. I don't wonder that part. You know, occasionally I may wonder why he did it,
right,
but I still
right.
know who did it.
Has God always been that savior to get you through? Has he always been there for you?
I am who I am because the great I am said so. So yes, he's always been there, even if I wasn't aware, even if I didn't acknowledge, even if after I became aware and acknowledged, I tried to run away and hide. Even those moments in which my ego did not allow me the time to stop and say thank you, thinking that it was all me. When I do get stopped and he does still stop me, I would drop to my knees and thank him. So he wasn't always, correction, he was always the head of my life. I didn't always acknowledge his place.
Agreed. I'm right there with you. The idea that I lost my job in late 2019 and I had no idea why. I'm asking, like, why now? Why this? And then it became evident within a few months, and I've talked about it on the podcast, so I don't necessarily need to get into that much detail, but it was a gift. It was an absolute gift to be able to be home with my wife, be home with my daughters as she fought cancer and they're in the pandemic, going to school online. And it was a gift. It didn't become apparent for several months, of course, but
right.
Everything like that is a gift.
Man, God is so amazing. Like, I was in love with this guy who lived in Chicago. And he was like really, probably like my first really like significant relationship after coming out. And I just thought, well, this is it. I found a guy, I'm good. And I was still living in Michigan. I was working for a newspaper in Michigan. He was living in Chicago. And I would drive back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And I kept trying to get a job in Chicago. Chicago Tribune wouldn't hire me. Chicago Sun-Times wouldn't hire me. Crane Communications wouldn't hire me. I would apply over and over and over again. Nothing, 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 nothing. I'd go to job conferences. Nothing, 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 nothing. Me and that guy didn't even last a year and a half. And on top of that, we also know what has happened to the newspaper industry, particularly in Chicago, particularly with the Sun-Times, which is the paper I really wanted to work at. And I tell God all the time, like, you saved me from me. Because there's no telling where I would be as a person and certainly where I would be as a professional if I had gotten my wish. If I had left the newspaper in New York or in Michigan and gone to Chicago and it had been in this relationship, no telling what would have occurred, right? But because his timing is better than our timing, I can now look back and go, shit, man, I'm so glad I didn't get that job in Chicago. So you're right. You never know, you know, what obstacles are actually stepping stones.
Run down for me, if you could, all the different things that you do now. Because I can think of three or four, but I'm sure there are probably three or four on top of that.
Well, first, I'm a dad. That's a full-time job, as you know.
Yep.
And just a heads up, it's permanent. I don't know if you know that or not.
You mean at 18, I can't just, no?
My kid here is 25 at the end of the year, Aaron. And there are moments in which I feel like I'm parenting more today than I did when he was an infant and needed me to carry him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because back then, you just do it, right? And that's not actually parenting. That's being a caretaker. Parenting is when that child can tell you no. Parenting is when, you know, you can't tell that child what to do anymore. That's when you start parenting. I didn't realize that until later in life when I was like going, God, why am I working so hard? Oh, now I'm parenting. Before, I would just tell him what to do. Before, I would just do it. Now I'm trying to teach, impart, instruct, guide. That's parenting. So, yes, my friend, you haven't even started. How old are your children?
6 and 8. Two daughters. Look at you.
You're barely a dad.
I know. I think about like the physical exhaustion when they were infants and, you know, they're 3, 6, 9 months old and they won't stop crying and they won't go to sleep and all that stuff. The emotional exhaustion of the last few years tops any of that physical exhaustion.
Yes.
By leaps and bounds.
Yes. And you wait till she grows up and gets hot. You wait till other people start recognizing, you know, things. Then you're going to be a parent.
I'm so worried.
Then you will be a parent. I was having this conversation. I think I was having this conversation on air. Actually, I was having this conversation on air. And, you know, people were saying, and I think I've actually written about this too, that it's easier to raise boys than to raise girls because of this dynamic that I'm talking about. And I always push back on that because it's very difficult to raise a young man not to be the things that society says you can get away with. It's very difficult to convince a young person not to do X, Y, and Z when society has this blanket boys will be boys cover that encourages them to just do whatever. So I think it's equally hard for both. They're just hard for different reasons. Because just as no one wants to raise a daughter who would be sexually attacked, I don't want to raise a child, a son, who will be a sexual attacker.
Right.
And society doesn't tell you to go out and be, you know, a pervert or a jerk or anything like that, but it doesn't treat it the same way that it does the victims of those things. It makes it feel as if it's not as bad. And so it's difficult to impart that it is as bad, if not worse, when everything around says the opposite. So as I said, you're just getting started. Enjoy the journey. Hit me up if you need any advice. I don't have anything that works, but I can tell you what I tried.
Yeah, I can't remember who it was, but when we had our first daughter, he turned to me and said, don't take advice from anyone. I do want to ask, you said 25-year-old son, what kinds of conversations have you had with him over the years growing up black in America?
Well, obviously, you know, we discussed the police. But we actually spend more time talking about our responsibilities. What can we do with our time here to make it better for the next generations? And I'm not just saying this because he's my son. I'm saying it because it's true. He is so much better than me, particularly at this point in life, from both in a self-awareness perspective, but also in a sense of responsibility perspective. So during the quarantining period of 2020, he and some of his former classmates in college created this nonprofit to help students like your daughter who are in school remotely and may not have a parent or parents around that can help tutor them once those classes are over with. He's created a nonprofit that links people that can help tutor kids who are studying remotely. And it's doing extremely well. He's now branched out. It started with a very, very, very small group of students from scratch, basically. And now he's working with students in DC. He's working with students in Chicago. And it's been really absolutely wonderful to see. But these are the conversations that we have. You know, it's not so much insular as much as, okay, we're blessed. We have resources. We have awareness. What can we, how can these things be applied so that the next generations can have it easier? So those are really more about the conversations we have, a lot less about how racism impacts us personally or interpersonally. Because he's really smart. He really doesn't need me to spend a great deal of time talking about that. As when I say he's better than me, like I went to, you know, regional schools, he went to NYU and turned down a whole bunch of other schools. When I asked him where he wanted to go to grad school, he's like, hey, I'm thinking about Stanford. They have the best program. So that's him, right? Me, I'm just like, yo, anybody lets me in, I'll right? be there, you know?
Yes. This might, and I've only heard of this in the last 6 months, but of course it's been around for a while, that idea of imposter syndrome. Like, yeah. I don't deserve more, and I don't mess, and what I do have, I don't deserve that either. You know, I do fight that. And I only learned about that in the last 6 months.
Yeah. I certainly have wrestled with that. It tends to be more of a woman in corporate America dynamic, you know, women in corporate America dynamic, feeling, you know, like you don't belong, you know, because it's such a male dominated area. But I certainly wrestle with it still to this day. In large part because I don't spend a great deal of time thinking about myself.
Is that good or bad?
Well, it depends, you know, because self-care is important too. And I have to be reminded to take care of myself because I'm really, really focused in on the issues that my life's work's about. And I will forget to take care of myself. And I will forget to think about myself. And I will consider the things I do not worthy of recognition or attention because I'm not interested in receiving any of those things. I'm only interested in resolution and problem solving. And when you have that sort of mindset, when you do receive accolades or when you do find yourself in spaces like the times I've been in the White House, and the president's right there. And I'm like, how the fuck did I get here? Right? But if I take a moment, a beat, and peel back and go, how did you get here? You work for ABC, you work for CNN, you work for several newspapers, you've done the work. You earned this place. But because I don't do that checklist, normally speaking, I just get right to how the hell did I get here?
How did you, as media evolved, how did you embrace these different platforms? As a writer who, you know, now you're on ABC, you're on the radio, you still write for newspapers and digital spaces. How did you, over the course of the evolution of media and your own evolution, how did you embrace those different platforms?
Because I saw them all as the same thing. You know, I recognize that the mediums are different, but my purpose doesn't change. You know, I'm a storyteller. And so when I think about what you're talking about, right? Radio, TV, writing, blah, 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 blah. At the end of the day, it's all storytelling. So I'm good because I know I can tell a story. So it wasn't that big of a challenge.
A lot of people here in Los Angeles, especially, they know you for sports. How much pushback have you gotten from sports fans or others that say, hey, just stick to sports, man?
I'm assuming it's there. I just don't pay attention to it.
How do you not pay attention to it? Because as somebody in media, you need clicks, you need ratings.
I don't pay attention to it because if you're really hitting me up talking about stick to sports, that means you don't know who the fuck I am anyway. So why am I paying attention to somebody who doesn't even know me, who hasn't even taken the time to even look at my career? No one who looks at my career would tell me to stick to sports because they know I've been covering politics and news for like almost as long as I've been covering sports. In fact, I've been doing that even longer. because it took me a minute to get into sports because no one would hire an openly gay guy to do sports. So I was actually covering politics and news before I was even covering sports. So anyone who comes at me will stick to sports or what do you know, blah, blah, blah. You don't know me. So why would I be bothered with your opinion of me? That's when I say, you know, I don't pay attention, because as soon as you tell me to stick to sports, what you're really saying is, I don't know who you are, but I have a criticism.
I don't know you, but here's my...
Right. I don't know anything about you, but I want you to limit yourself to a smaller bite so that I can easily digest whatever it is you're trying to say or share with me.
You are still a big hockey guy? Like hockey is still your biggest?
Not nearly as big as it was like 15 years ago. Once I started working for CNN, so I started off as a Metro guy. Metro, did features, Metro, and then I switched over to sports, right? And then once I got to ESPN, it was all sports. But once I decided to try to balance sports with news, and I went over to CNN as well, I realized very quickly that my depth of knowledge and my ability to maintain that knowledge will have to be tweaked a little bit. And so I had to drop some things off on the sports side to allow myself more capacity and bandwidth to educate myself or stay on top of political things. So college sports have dropped off. Hockey has dropped off. NBA is such a part of me, is basically my skin. If NBA is my skin, then tennis are my bones and muscles, right? So those sports, I still have a great deal of both institutional knowledge, which digs deep, as well as the bandwidth to know both the irreverent stuff as well as, you know, the important matches of the day. Like, I watched Tsitsipas win his first Masters 1000. No, you probably don't know who that is.
No, I don't.
He's a great young tennis player. We've been waiting for some new tennis player to finally break through, whether it's him or Zverev or Dominic Thiem, who won the U.S. Open last year. So he had his breakthrough, though some question whether or not it was a real breakthrough because he didn't have to face anyone from the big three. We used to be four, but Andy Murray's hurt. And now he's coming back. So now it's big three. So I can go on and on and on.
I was going to say, I'm glad I asked this toward the end of the conversation, because if I started with this, it would just be an hour of you with tennis.
I can do the exact same thing when it comes to, like, the MCU. And I can do the exact same thing when it comes to, you know, policies as it pertains to, like, infrastructure, or when it comes to, you know, racial politics or LGBTQ equality. Like, so I've narrowed it to here so that I can dig deeper there. So that's how I kind of characterize it, I guess.
What do you do for self-care? You brought it up a few minutes ago. What do you do when you need to unplug and decompress?
The first thing I do is I take this and I take it to the closet and I leave it there. That's the first thing I do. Put it in the closet, leave it there, bam. Second thing I do is spend time with my family. You know, the people, the day ones before I had a day one, you know, the original day ones. You know, my family and friends, I love to read. I don't drink nearly as much as I used to. Basically, I don't drink at this point, but I still smoke. So I definitely enjoy a good herb. But yeah, that's basically, and I love music. I listen to a lot of music. I love concerts. I miss concerts.
What's the next concert that you, like, if you could snap your fingers, concerts all back in session, and there's one tomorrow, you're invited to it, which one is that?
Avett Brothers, Red Rocks in Colorado.
Boom, without skipping a beat. Why?
Because it was a concert that I was planning on going to in 2020, 4th of July weekend. It was the concert that I've been planning to do for a very long time, actually, because I love the Avett Brothers, and I've never been to Red Rocks, but I've been told repeatedly about the acoustics, and I've seen the acoustics on documentaries, and so that was supposed to have been my show in July, the July 4th weekend. So as soon as things are really up and running, that will be the first concert. I want to see them there.
Where can people find you? How can people get a hold of you, get a hold of your work?
So I work for the Los Angeles Times. I'm an op-ed columnist there. Sedano, Elzie, and Kaplan is the radio show for ESPN 710, and that's from 4 to 7 p.m. Pacific. The podcast is also available. You can hear it streaming live on the ESPN app. Work for ABC. So, you know, I can't tell you where I would be when.
Yeah, that's as needed, right?
As needed. You know, but I do This Week, Good Morning America, ABC News Live. Sometimes I write pieces if I'm able to. And that's, you know, it for right now. I've dropped off a lot of other jobs that I still have. Like, I no longer am ringside reporter for DAZN. Largely because of the pandemic, I'm no longer working red carpets for Marvel. As far as the core work, those three jobs are the ones that I kind of am keeping in the air. And honestly, that's plenty.
We didn't even get into the entertainment side of things, because you also dip more than just a toe into the entertainment reporting and entertainment world. It just hit me. We didn't even get into that.
I guess that means I have to come back.
Please do. Please do. LZ, thank you, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Aaron. Really appreciate it, brother. Really do.
We should take this opportunity. Shout out Greg Bergman, because he gave me your number last year when I was doing some kind of coronavirus conversations as people were adjusting to life during the pandemic. And that was, honestly, that was about the time that my wife's condition just got that much worse. So when I reached out this year, I'm grateful that you replied. I'm grateful that you accepted. And I'm grateful for this conversation, man. Thank you.
No worries at all. G is a good man. I'm assuming he only hangs around good people. So it's all good with me, man. It really is. And you have my number. You know, I like your vibe. Stay in touch.
Thank you, man.
If you want to have him back on, just let me know.
I'll keep up with you on social media for when you go to that concert. And I want to talk to you after that concert and see how, you know, if it lived up to the hype. That's a deal.
Yeah.
I've put links to LZ's social media and LA Times column in the show notes. And please pop over to YouTube to subscribe to the Aaron Bender podcast channel and like the Aaron Bender podcast on Facebook. All my links are at AaronBender.com. If you have guest ideas or comments, email me, AaronBenderMedia@gmail.com. Be well, and thanks for listening.